thing. Okay, I'm recording. This is Andy Johnson, the Reading Instruction Show, and I'm here with Claude Goldenberg, and he was saying such good stuff that I said, don't waste it on me. So we got to let other people hear this good stuff. So, Claude, you were talking about the importance that we discuss, that we have differing views on things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, disagreements are, we shouldn't shy away from them. You know, we shouldn't fear them. We should, I mean, not to be Pollyannish about it, but, you know, we should embrace them. But we should embrace them in the sense of wanting to understand other people's perspectives, which then helps us understand our own perspectives. And so when I reached out to you a couple of weeks ago in anticipation of the webinar that you hosted with my colleagues, sort of from CABE, California Association for Bilingual Education, I was just thrilled that you responded positively. I asked you to, you know, maybe do a guest gig on my Substack. You invited me to be here on your podcast, and here we are. I mean, I welcome it, and I thank you for it.
And I look for people that might have differing ideas. Because as I was telling Claude, as I encounter new information, rational human beings evolve and change their thinking. And the way I think about things 10 years ago is different than I do today. And I hope it's different in 10 more years. I hope I continue to evolve and change my thinking. Does that make me wishy-washy? No, that makes me a good human being.
I agree. And I want to join you in that category, you know, of not wishy-washy, but open to consider other perspectives. And as I was telling you, my frustration is when it's difficult to engage with people, when they don't want to hear other perspectives or explain to me their perspective. And I was just contrasting the reaction I got from you to the reaction I got when I tried to reach out to Edgar
somebody
Lampton,
else. Yep.
Somebody else. Okay, fair enough. Somebody else who was just not interested in discussing with me. And I find that unfortunate because we get stuck in our, I mean, we can talk about it politically. There's a lot of that going on politically. Enough said about that. But in our own world of literacy research and practice and policy, there's just not sufficient engagement, to use a political term, across the aisle. And I find that very dispiriting, very dispiriting. So I want to, again, thank you and applaud you for your openness.
And I agree as well. When I post online, I do have snarky language sometimes. I admit that up front. But I've tried reason and research for years, and I'm pretty much ignored. But if people respond to me, I will respond to their ideas in a respectful way. But it's usually demeaning. I haven't taught, I don't know anything, and this or that and the other thing, which is fine. I could be a bad human being. Well, that's a given. But what exactly do you disagree with me about?
Yeah,
so that,
good
and
enough.
I find it troubling that teachers are afraid to speak out because they fear for their jobs about literacy.
Yes, that is true. That is absolutely, people feel, and again, it's true. It's not just in our field. It's not just in our domain. It's a kind of a general human condition. And again, we're seeing this in many domains and spheres of life. It is really unfortunate when people feel like they can't express another opinion, another perspective. You know, it is kind of a balancing act because on the one hand, you know, there needs to be cohesion in organizations and in whatever human endeavors, you know, networks and so forth, because without cohesion, everything just sort of fragments. But at the same time, you need to make room. You know, you want to get away from groupthink, you
yes,
know, from just hanging out with the people who agree with you, reinforce you. And that has problems of its own. So we agree in principle, but actually enact that is a challenge. And it's a constant struggle to kind of balance the two. Need for cohesion, but also need space for individuals to express their concerns, bring different information to the fore, different data, call it research, call it perspectives. that's the balancing act that I think is very difficult to pull off, but I think we have to aim for all the time.
Okay. Well, one of the things that led to this conversation was the idea of the reading wars. Do you want to start there?
Sure.
Okay.
So the question, I guess, when you start there, do we start with the question of is there a reading war? Are there reading wars? And just to backfill a little bit for you and our audience, on this Substack that I started a few months ago, I invited people to a conversation.
And what's a Substack? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. Oh, I thought it seemed to me like you were a social media gonzo. So
No.
so a Substack is like it's like a gussied up blog.
Okay.
It's a really a wonderful platform where people can, post their ideas, invite people to engage. It's very, very similar to a blog, but it's got a lot of other attributes that make it sort of ready-made for this kind of free exchange of ideas.
Can
It's
you
become
have
very popular
recorded
there.
comments and interaction?
Yes. In
Okay.
fact, that's what I'm trying to get more involved. So my first foray into this was to host a conversation. I was hoping to do it on the Substack. I mean, if anyone's interested, just go to substack.com and you'll find out what this is. And if you search for me, you can find my Substack, which is entitled "We Must End the Reading Wars Now." So the first conversation I want to have with people, which you actually had on Zoom, because Substack is not a really good platform for the kind of interaction with lots of people that I wanted to have. So we started on Substack, then we moved over to Zoom.
Okay.
And the opening question was, oh, is there a reading war? I
Well,
mean,
let's have
because I
that
think
conversation
absolutely.
because I know our
And
audience wants us to get into reading.
yes, absolutely. So, a lot of it is sort of semantics. That's what language is, sound and meaning. That's language, meaning semantics. Whether you call it a war, whether you call it a kerfuffle, whether you call it a series of freighted discussions. And you're right. In one of your emails, Andy, you said that was a term that was coined by the media. And that's actually true. The first, according to my AI bots and the research that I've done, the first instance of the reading wars appearing in print was in an Edweek article from 35 years ago. An article by someone named Robert Rothman, and the title of the article in Edweek was "From a Great Debate to a Full-Scale War: Disputes Over Teaching Reading Heats Up." So it was coined in the media, but in fact, it's been picked up by academics. I mean, Jeff and Peter Bowers, I'm sure you know them, UK academics. They wrote an article in the Washington Post on the reading wars. Brian Camborne, I'm sure you know that name. He wrote A Brief History of the Reading Wars. Our own famous David Pearson, eminent academic in this area. He wrote a 2004 article in Educational Policy called The Reading Wars. So it's not true that it's a purely, how should I say, journalistic confabulation, something constructed by the media in order to make people fight against each other. It's been adopted very wide scale, the term. Now, has it outlived its usefulness? I think undoubtedly yes. That's why I think we need to end it. Whatever you call it, kerfuffle. Now, we still have disagreements, but we should have the kind of disagreements that you and I are having, that we'll get into some substantive issues. But the people on the Zoom that we had all agreed, yeah, there are these wars, and there are these wars, and they're not helpful to anyone, certainly not the children. And we need to figure out a way to talk through them, think about them, engage in a way where the warlike metaphor no longer makes sense. I think that was
Okay.
the message I got.
Very good. Very good. So I will cede your point that it has leaked over to some in the educational context. That's a given. It is used. And I agree with you that it's outlived its usefulness. And I don't like the war concept because that leads to destruction and good argument an argument, not in the case of I'm yelling at you, but argument, making a proposition and supporting your proposition, is at the heart of academic discourse and heart of the academy. And last I checked, reading and teaching was an academic endeavor.
Yes,
Last I
100%.
checked, maybe it's changed.
No, I couldn't have said it better. So I'm not going to repeat it because you're
Oh, okay.
exactly
Okay.
right.
So, starting at the point that definitely the reading war, let's just leave that aside because there's differing views. And it
Yes.
seems to me those who are meaning first versus skills first approach to teaching reading. Are you okay with that, or where are you at with that?
Okay, great.
The
That's a great
differences
starting point.
in two positions, do you say? Maybe
A
there's more than
absolutely.
two.
Yeah. Well, I think you hit the heart of the matter. There's been this long-standing, I mean long-standing. In fact, it goes back to Brian Camburn's article. It's fairly recent. It's like 2021. I'll send you the link, A Brief History of the Reading Wars. And he puts the fundamental debate back to an article by a German educator, I'd never heard this, in 1779. Now, the interesting thing is that was the heart of the Enlightenment, or towards the end of the Enlightenment. And what it came down to was some version of code or phonics or letters and sounds versus meaning. What should be the leading edge of teaching and learning, reading and becoming literate? Now, this has been a binary. This has been a binary that has driven this debate, discussion, war, whatever, for 250 years. And I think the binary is what is extremely harmful. We need to get away from this dysfunctional binary because it is not, do you just look at the code or you just look at meaning? They are both important, but in different ways. And I think the difficulty is thinking about how reading is a function, is a product of navigating the code while at the same time making sure meaning is central to the whole operation. It's not a binary. We've got to get past the binary.
And part of the problem, the interruption of the conversation, are those who seek to make teaching an algorithm, a one size fits all. If teachers would just buy my fancy product or do these in these steps, then we can guarantee that learning will occur, like the Charlotte Danielson model.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, how should I call, say, kind of super, I think, superficial thinking, either looking for something off the shelf that will solve all of your reading problems,
Yes.
or going to some reading guru
That's right.
and that will
We're
solve your reading
one
problems.
product away. If I just buy this product, then my reading problems will be solved. And there
Yeah.
are no educational messiahs.
No. No, there aren't. In fact, I heard Michael Fullan one time say the reason people refer to gurus is because they can't spell charlatan.
Yes.
So if anyone calls you a guru, say, that's masking charlatan.
I always tell my audience, I say, I have no answers for you. I have ideas. Take the ideas that work for you.
No, I think that's a very important point. I would say beyond that, Andy, that what we really need is for people, teachers, certainly, parents, of course, the public in general, policymakers, God help us, to have a
God
deeper
help us.
understanding.
God help us.
And I'm an atheist, right? So I'm reaching for straws here.
Let's see. We can agree on that. God
Yeah, we
help
did.
us.
You're making me laugh too much. I'm not going to be
Okay.
able to get anything out. So we need a deeper understanding of what learning to read involves, what involves inside the brain, and what has to happen outside of the brain to facilitate, enable, promote that process. We need a deeper understanding. We need to get past that dysfunctional binary that says either this or that, or this guru or that guru, or this off-the-shelf product or that off-the-shelf product. We just need to get into that. And if you want to get in a little more deeper into what I mean by that, I'm happy to go there, but I don't want to keep
Well,
talking.
let me pick up on your concept of God. Hang with me. You
Oh,
know,
God.
I was sitting in a church and I was thinking, even though everyone here kind of thinks they believe the same thing, everyone has a different take on things. You cannot assume a monolithic agreement, not by teachers, not by educators, not even by people who are adherent of a particular religion. So
That's probably true. That's probably true.
that's what made me think of it when you went off on the atheist thing. So
Okay.
back to the meaning first versus code. There's always, I don't want to call it a pendulum swing, but there's been those who have used the illusion of crisis for their own benefit. Part of the change in the early 2000s is a result of the 2002 Educational Act, which said the only knowledge that counts is that which comes from controlled experimental studies conducted in an actual classroom. And I think that's a very restricted view of what counts for knowledge, but that's the only kind of knowledge that the government would fund. Therefore, you saw this change in the types of research being published. I would be okay with that if it were applied in all cases. And in the case of the science of reading, that tends not to be the case.
What tends not to be the case?
Well, let's take an example. For example, letters professional development. That is not used to differentiate the letters thing. If that same standard were used, has letters shown to improve student achievement? Has letters been shown to improve teacher effectiveness? Has letters been compared with something else? That's kind of the standard.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, to my knowledge, there's been no randomized experiment that has demonstrated that letters versus something else will lead to better results. Now, there are lots of explanations for that. Some people will call them rationalizations, some will call it excuses, but it is true. But at the same time, I think it's important to try to understand. And believe me, I have no stock in letters industries, right? I do some consulting for Lexia, like I do some consulting and give talks for other people who want me to come and talk to their staff or sponsor conferences or webinars, but I don't have stock in any of these industries. So just full disclosure. But there is some very important knowledge, teacher knowledge, that letters contains that I believe would be of benefit if more people understood. Now, there's some issues with letters. For one thing, it's like a 2-year, heavily, very, very intensive program that requires that a lot of it's expensive in terms of teacher time,
Yes.
in terms of school district time, in terms of all sorts of things. And there's really no evidence that I know of that all of that that's contained in there is really not even necessary or by no means sufficient to actually be a more effective teacher and help kids. So there are some legitimate questions to be asked. At the same time, I know from talking to people, teachers, administrators, a lot of people feel like this is good foundational knowledge that's helped them understand things that their teacher preparation program did not prepare them to understand.
Okay,
And
let's
I think
unpack.
we can, yeah, we can't, we, I think we can't lose sight of that,
There's a couple
the
things
value. Yeah, go.
to unpack there. First of all, I don't consult for anybody. I don't make any money beyond my university salary. My books don't even pay enough to support the website. So that is said up front. The knowledge in letters, it has not been shown that this knowledge, and tell me about the knowledge, orthographic mapping, for example. That's one thing that's been shown to be important. People may think it's important, but is it indeed important? Does it contribute to our ability to teach and learn?
Yeah.
I
I'm
use
sorry,
the
go ahead. I
phrase
thought.
that orthographic mapping is a thing. But semantic mapping is more of a thing.
Well, they're both things. In fact, if you really let's talk about orthographic mapping. I mean, I don't know how weedy you want to get. We can get really kind of weedy, and you tell me if I'm going off the deep end here. But this is where breaking down the binary, I think, is really important, because if you think about the concept of orthographic mapping, one of Linnaeus' most important contributions to our understanding. What orthographic mapping means, literally, is that the individual, the beginning reader, and then as you go through your reading development, it continues. You don't leave orthographic mapping in the dust once you pass second grade. But what orthographic mapping means is that the individual binds or connects or maps the spelling of a word, right? Its orthographic representation, its visual representation. It maps the spelling of the word to the pronunciation of the word. The phonemic aspect, the phonemic representation is mapped to the orthographic representation. That's orthographic mapping. Now, that mapping then gets linked to the meaning of the word. So you have the mapping of the phonology to the orthography, then to the semantics. You see, that breaks down the binary right there, because it's like this three-legged stool that is
Let's stop
involved in
right there
learning a
with
word.
three-legged stools and whatnot. Louisa
Okay.
Moltz has done a lot of quote research, and her research essentially is surveys and tests. That knowledge, that linguistic knowledge, is not essential in reading. When you hear the word cat, you don't link it with orthographic memory, and I'll call it memory versus mapping, because the mapping, as she describes it, is a form of memory. When you hear the word cat, you link it with semantic memory. Now, that doesn't mean that semantic mapping does not exist. It does. But during the act of reading, we engage semantic memory, and we don't see words floating in space outside of context. We always see words in the context of a sentence. So that's where I would say, okay, well, that knowledge is of interest, but I think it's more important. The human brain creates patterns based on semantic knowledge. Thank you for your patience.
No,
So
not at all.
that's where I would disagree with Aries and letters, that this knowledge is important to be a good teacher, and it simply is not, has not been proven to be necessary or sufficient for
Okay,
helping
so
children
let's
create meaning with print. Does it raise scores
understood,
on
understood.
tests? Perhaps. On a measure of spelling? Perhaps. Does it raise scores on a phonics test? Perhaps. But these are short-term games and not long-term. Anyway.
So let's dig a little deeper, because I mentioned, and I don't know a lot of, I'm not a neuro, full disclosure, I'm not a neuroscientist, right? I don't know the difference between my earlobe and my prefrontal lobe, so don't ask me any hard questions. But what I know, what I believe I know, what I think is true from the neuroscientist I've read and interacted with, is that certain things need to happen in the brain in order to read, right? Now, before I get into that, let me make a kind of statement here that you may or may not agree with. And that is that learning to speak and understand oral language is related to, but different from, learning to read and write written language.
I
Oral
think I would
language,
agree with that.
okay, good. Written language and oral language are distinct. Related, but distinct.
I've written, they are can inform each other, but they are not the same.
Okay,
Yes.
perfect. So far so good.
See, this is good. We agree
It's
on.
good. I knew it. I was very optimistic, and my optimism is being borne out, I'm happy to say. Okay,
Yes.
so they're different. Now, We are born, and there's evidence to this from developmental neurobiologists and evolutionary developmental psychologists and so forth. There's evidence, and I believe it's true, that we are born wired to attend to and make sense of human speech. When an individual, a neonate, a newborn, a very young baby, the oral stimulus, the oral signal that most gets its attention is human speech. Now, if you have a loud noise, there's a startle reflex, right? That's kind of a reflex. But what gets volitional attention is human speech.
Let me jump in there just
Yes.
on that point.
Sure.
There are over 200 phonemes in the human language, and at birth, humans can perceive all of them. But
Yes.
through the act of pruning, that some of
Yes.
these neural pathways disappear, and the ones in your language become strengthened. So
Yes.
around age 16 months to 18 months, human beings have evolved to be able to attend to the phonemes around it. So this is a little bit different, but I think it's an important distinction that we're not hardwired. We're hardwired to attend to our environment.
Well, more specifically, not just to, it's differentiated. We're hardwired to attend specifically to the sounds of human speech. That will get more attention than a truck passing by, than the music going on. I mean, I don't say this from my own experiments because I don't do those experiments, but the development, I can give you a citation if you'd like. But the developmental psychologists who study these things have found that the oral signal, stimulus, call it what you will, that most gets babies' attention is human speech, regardless of the phoneme, because you're right, we're set up to process whatever and over time, but whatever human speech stream comes in, that's what babies most respond to orally, just like visually, the human face gets most of their attention
And
visually.
the case is because that's a mother and a human being responding vocally to those things around them. In a thought experiment, if some baby did not or could not hear, then they would attend to visual signs or whatever. But
Well,
it's that interaction that creates meaning.
Andy, I mean, thought experiments are okay, but they don't have any data. That's the problem with thought experiments. And an
Well,
actual experiment.
there's data to support the idea of pruning
Well,
that we
I'm
attend,
not.
and there's
I'm
data
not.
to support that we're not hardwired for voices over one thing. You know, there is
Yes.
data, it's how we interpret the data.
Well, the pruning data I don't dispute, and I don't think it's particularly relevant here, but it's an interesting point. The data that I'm talking about is that human speech gets the attention of very young babies more so than any other oral stimulus or signal, right?
We agree on
Now,
that, but it's the cause why they do it. That's
well, yes.
how we interpret that, the
Well,
cause.
when babies are just out of the womb, how would you interpret the fact that they are born more attentive to human speech than any other oral stimulus? How would you interpret that? They're born with it. How would you interpret that?
So a newborn attends to the sound of a voice more than a clicking of the fingers. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Correct.
Interesting. Well, that could be an innate thing. I don't know that to be true. I don't know
Okay.
that to be true.
Okay,
But we
I'll
know
send you
in the
I'll
early
send you the
months
reference. Yeah,
because it
I'll
has
send you the
been ex
references if you want.
all right, it's been
Yeah.
exposed to human voice both in the womb and
That's
as
right.
first comes
That's
out.
right.
I mean, that could
So
be
the
explained, but it's how we
they
interpret
could.
that.
That's fine. But what you said is key. It's innate. I mean, you offered that as a possibility. I think that is the strongest possibility. I won't say settled science. I will
Thank
say
you.
the strongest possibility is that attending to human speech right out of the chute is innate. That's the thing that gets most attention. Now, contrast that with print. Do you know any newborn that attends to print? Does it have any innate, intrinsic
I don't
knowledge?
think the comparison is apt because developmentally they are not ready to be exposed to print.
Well,
They
that's
can't
right.
see.
That's right. It takes a while because they have to learn that this gets back to your point about how important meaning is.
Yes.
We are meaning seekers. We are meaning creators,
That's
meaning
the human
seekers,
brain, yes.
meaning makers. Absolutely. And the best interpretation that I know of these data is that intrinsically we know, in quotation marks, because it's unknown what a 2-day-old knows, but intrinsically, inherently, we know that something meaningful is coming in when human speech is coming in. That's why that's more gets children's attention, baby's attention, more so than clicking your fingers or a truck passing by or something. In contrast, there's no way for them to know that there's something meaningful going on when you put print in front of them. They haven't been exposed to it.
And again, that is an unfair comparison
Okay.
because children are learning everything. And
Yeah.
if they're exposed to print over time, we learn print. They're not exactly the same. No one says
No, no,
that you learn
no,
to
they're not.
read naturally. You
Exactly.
learn to speak in part because you are immersed in it. It responds to you in a very natural way. And we can
Right.
use
So,
that understanding to help us understand how we can better learn to read.
yeah. Well, if I could just one quibble
Sure.
here. You said no one says we learn to read naturally. That's not entirely true. I'm sure you're familiar with the Goodman's paper, Learning to Read is Natural.
Yes.
Now, they distance themselves from a Rousseauian position, I know, but there is this, and the Goodmans were important in propagating this. There is this idea that learning to read is natural, and if you surround children with literacy and engage them in print and so on and so forth, they will. It's a false analogy. What I'm getting at is it's a false analogy to say that we learn print, reading and writing, how to navigate written language. It's analogous to how we learn to navigate oral language. That's the point I'm trying to make. They are
And
really acquired in different ways.
I would say a couple of things. We learn to read naturally. That does not mean there's instruction. There is not instruction in the
Okay.
code.
Okay.
We
Okay.
it's a
Okay, but
natural inclination to make sense. Children
yes.
are sense-making beings,
Absolutely.
and children try to make sense of things. Pre-decoding children try to make sense of that print. So it is a natural thing to want to learn to read. That does not mean there's an absence of phonics instruction. And I
Great.
think,
Yeah.
and I would say as well, you know, what the Goodmans wrote in 67, they evolved. Their thinking changed over time. And
Okay.
the whole language of 1975 or the psycholinguistic theory is different than the psycholinguistic theory of 2025.
Okay, fair enough. So let's talk about that because related to all of this is, you know, whole language, psycholinguistic theory, three queuing, balanced literacy, all these kind of charged terms
Yes, charged
that
terms.
get people up in arms and not
Yes.
communicating.
Yes.
So let's talk about, and tell me if you agree with this. I mean, I think, and a lot of people think, this is not an original observation, that in this evolution, what you're calling an evolution, and I completely accept that, that what was whole language in the 80s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s maybe, has since evolved into something like three queuing, balanced literacy. It's kind of like the latter day progeny, shall we say, of whole language. Would you agree with that general conception?
I would say people are confusing the terms. Whole language can be, is it a theory? Is it a philosophy? Let us say that it's I'll call it a theory that humans best learn within the context of the whole. When language is
Okay.
whole and complete, that does not mean, and a lot of people understood it as, oh, no phonics. your phonics or your whole language. No. Phonics instruction is included in whole language, absolutely, but within a holistic context to the greatest extent possible. Meaning there's
Okay.
some isolated word study, but we try to minimize that.
And you minimize it. Why do you try to minimize it? What's the rationale for that?
The rationale is that it can best be understood. It's less than an abstraction if you're doing phonics instruction within the context of a sentence. So
Okay.
they're not reliant on letter cues, that they're able to use semantics and syntax as well.
Right. So this actually gets back to how the difference between acquiring oral language and acquiring written language, and the, let me just say, the premise or the hypothesis that acquiring oral language is innate. I mean, we're kind of wired to acquire it, whereas learning written language, and you're right in the sense that it's not unnatural because learning and teaching are natural. Right. I mean, this is the point that David Pearson has made in discussions I've had with him. And it's an error to make this distinction between learning to speak and understand is natural, whereas learning to read and write is unnatural. I mean, that's another false dichotomy, a false binary.
Yes.
It's learning to speak, learning to read and write is no more unnatural, or I should say, is no less natural than any kind of teaching and learning that we do. I mean, teaching and learning is part of the natural human being psyche. People want to learn, absent developmental anomalies, but even kids who have disabilities. And I mean, people want to learn, they want to grow, they want to understand, they want to make meaning, they want to communicate.
And to build
That
on that
that's all
natural
true.
thing, I would say that human language is not innate. It's the learning that's innate. Learning to make sense of patterns, to fill in the blank,
Right.
that gestalt. So
Okay.
oral learning is as natural. It's the learning, it's the trying to make sense of things that is the natural
Right.
thing.
That's right. But also teaching. I mean, I think where our disagreement lies is in the extent to which, in order to learn to read and write, you need to, at some level, be taught in an explicit way, in a way that is not necessary for learning to speak and understand. Sure, you learn things from modeling, when we're speaking, when children are learning to speak, way before literacy per se is an issue. They learn to speak, they hear people speak, they engage in speaking, they make utterances that are meaningless, but they're interpreted by their parents as, oh, isn't that cute? He's trying to say. Right, it's a meaning-making and constructing activity, because the word, again, absent developmental anomalies, you're trying to communicate and understand and have people understand you orally. But learning to navigate written language is a different sort of thing, because it requires, and it varies. Some kids need very little. It seems some, you know as well as I do, that some kids learn to read as if as they learn to read and speak and understand. I mean,
I agree
that's a
with two
given.
things that you said.
Yeah, sure.
You said it's different. Children learn differently. I would agree with that. It varies.
No,
And
I'm sorry. I said they learn to read and write and speak and understand differently.
okay, but the t amount and type of instruction varies that they need. All right.
Well, yes,
Okay.
that
And
part,
I
correct.
would say that all human beings need that instruction, need that explicit instruction. I agree with you. It's not the
Okay.
what of phonics instruction, it's the how and the how much.
Yes.
Therein, I think, lies the difference.
Yes, I agree. And part of the thing that makes it difficult is, we were talking about how we all have a tendency
This
for
is a good
sight.
thing, by the way. We've
Yes.
got to the heart, we've found kind of the heart of a disagreement.
I think so. I think so. I think there are actually several hearts, but this is definitely an important one. I
It's a
mean,
big heart.
Let's
You've got
beat
a
this
big
one,
heart,
okay?
Claude. You're a big-hearted man.
Yeah, well, thank you. And likewise, I'm sure. So, yeah, so this is true. It's tremendous variability, as there is in all sorts of human activities. So, some kids need very little direct instruction, other kids need a whole lot. Most of us normal mortals are, somewhere in
I agree
between.
with you on that. You.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the question is, how much, as you said, how much and how to provide the necessary instruction in the act of reading. And by reading, I'm going to define reading right now very narrowly.
Okay.
And I realize it's a much more expansive thing. We can talk about reading
Yeah, let's
very
get our
narrowly.
definitions of reading first. That might
Yeah,
help you.
yeah. I mean, reading can be defined very narrowly as being able to pronounce a word that's written on a page, right? That's a very narrow definition of reading. But reading is also metaphorical, all the way up to reading the room, right? I mean, and all points in between. We say someone is literate, and we don't mean necessarily they can read and write, but they're familiar with a certain literary canon. How many times we hear, oh, he's barely literate. What does that mean? Well, they haven't read the important books, and so they're not really literate, even though they can read and
Back
write.
to reading. I would define reading as creating meaning with print.
Okay,
You
great.
can sound out words in Latin, but you are not creating meaning. In the same way,
Right.
children read and have meaningful miscues, but are still generating deep meaning.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the
Well,
difference.
that's fine. I mean, how many times have you heard people say, and I have a lot, well, I can read it. I can read Latin. I can read Spanish. I can read Finnish, but I don't understand it. Are they using reading incorrectly? No, they're not using reading in the way that you're saying reading means.
They're not reading, they're sounding out the words, and there's a
Well,
difference.
but people say, I can read, but I don't understand it. In which case you would say, no, you're not reading. If you're not understanding, you are incorrect in saying you can read it. Would you correct them?
No, I would say you're not comprehending. There's a
Okay,
lack
but
of
you said you're not
comprehension.
reading. You
They
can
are
you
attempting to read, they are
attempting to
not
read. Okay.
comprehending what they read.
Okay, fair enough. They're
They're
not
attempting to
comprehending.
create meaning, they're just
Right.
a little short.
My only point is that there are different definitions of reading which are operative depending on what you're talking about. So let's go with your definition that reading is making meaning and comprehending.
Creating
Now,
meaning with print.
creating meaning with print. That's right. Now, and this gets back to the difference between acquiring oral language and acquiring written language. And I just want to delve into the brain for just a minute. I gave my disclaimer about not being a neuroscientist, but what I believe is true, and I think has been demonstrated. I'm not going to say settled science. I mean, it's a toxic term, but it's been demonstrated, and the data support the proposition that in order to be able to read, there's got to be created something that's known as the reading circuit or the literacy circuit, where areas of the brain that are involved in processing sound, phonology, and processing the visual representations, the orthography, connect with oral language, how that makes meaning, the semantic aspects. I said something about a three-legged stool with respect to orthographic mapping. That
I know.
three-legged stool has an analogy in our brain. You've got to connect phonology to orthography to semantics. That connection is what makes reading possible. Without
Okay.
that connection, reading is either extremely difficult or some might say impossible. That's what needs to happen in the brain. Phonology, orthography, semantics, reading circuits.
Let me respond. I too am not a neurologist, but I have tried to bring myself up to speed on the brain research, and I know a lot of the stuff. Dennehy, is that Stanislav?
Dehan,
The
Stanislas Dehan.
methodology when they look at one word out of context and find which parts of the brain light up, that's not reading. That's
And that's not
pronouncing a
what they
word.
study. That's Andy, that is a misrepresentation of those studies, I
That
think.
is many of the studies. We must look at the methodology behind these studies. Are
Absolutely.
they studying reading online as it occurs? Are
Yes.
they studying a variety of people? Are they studying one or two people? Looking
No.
at words lighting up.
Words in meaning, in context, in sentences. Yes, they absolutely study that. 100%. And don't believe me. I mean, don't believe DeHaan if you don't want to. I mean, you can Kenneth Pugh. I mean,
No,
there are
I
many, many neuroscientists who are studying this and will
yes.
tell you they study small bits, but they study semantics, sentences,
Yes.
paragraph reading. Yes, they study that. They absolutely study that.
And again, there are many, many neuroscientists in the literacy world that have come to different conclusions and find problems in the methodology. So
Which
when we say
ones
many,
would you say?
huh?
Yeah, who like for who for example? For example, who has found problems with methodology? Who, for example?
Stephen Strauss?
He is not a neuroscientist. He
Yes,
is
he
not
is.
a
He's a
neuro No,
PhD. Oh, a
he's a
neuroscientist.
neurologist. He's an MD neurologist. He's a clinician. And I'm sure he's a very good clinician. I'm not going to say a single bad thing about him, other than the fact that he doesn't know what he's talking about when he disputes the findings based on methodology of the neuroscience. I mean, he just doesn't know. He's not a neuroscientist. Try to find a single article by him on any research he's done. You cannot. I've looked up and down. I've asked him. I've asked the people who push his theories and anti-theories forward. No one can come up with a single piece of research that this gentleman has done. I'm sure he's a great clinician, but neuroscientist, I guarantee you he is not.
All right, that is my homework assignment, to look at a neuroscientist, look for research by a neuroscientist that comes to a
Yes.
different conclusion.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Yes, please. And I'd love to see it because
Okay.
as like you, I'm always looking for things that challenge what I've come to conclude for whatever reason.
Yes.
So yeah, please find it and
Absolutely.
send it to me because I'm being completely on the level here. I've asked around. No one can come up with something that he's actually any research he's done.
And I'm the
So
same way.
that
If I find some research that says something different, I'm happy to make a whole podcast saying I was wrong.
I admire you, Andy. I really admire you. I really do because
It's
people are not sufficiently circumspect about the tentativeness of a lot of our knowledge. It's tenuous, and we got to deal with it. And I admire that.
And it's very hard to change
Yeah.
once you're embedded in a certain worldview, a paradigm.
Absolutely.
It would be very hard, just like it'd be very having that political discussion with my brother. I'm not going to change his mind.
Well, let's hope we can rise above the politics of the moment. Do you think we can?
I don't know. Jesus could come back and write in big mile high sky letters that I'm right, and my brother still wouldn't believe me.
I'm not
Or
going to
Buddha
touch
or
that one.
whoever could come back and write.
I'm not going to touch that one. I'll take your word for
Or Claude could get a airplane and write in big letters. All
Yeah,
right.
I can't afford one, so you don't have to worry
No,
about that.
we've come to and I don't want to get too far, but we've come to some very good points where we disagree. And let's see if we can summarize the things where we have differing views on. What do you think we have differing views on?
I think what I would identify as different view is what and how much direct and explicit, I don't want to say phonics, but really foundation, I think more of foundational literacy skills, from phonemic awareness, letters and sounds, phonics and decoding, and fluency, right? That little basket of things that goes by the shorthand of phonics, but is really more than just phonics, foundational literacy skills. And I think where we have a disagreement is how much direct and explicit, and I'll throw in systematic foundational skills instruction is necessary for children or just normal people, anyone who can't read or doesn't read, how much of that is necessary to facilitate and propel literacy acquisition and development? How much of that is really necessary?
And I would think number one, it's possible to have a conversation with people who disagree. That's one. I think that's one we agree on. I think our definition of reading differs, and our definition of how and how much, we'll call it phonics instruction. Is there a better word, phonology?
Well, I just think of foundational literacy skills, because I think of those as the things that connect the sounds of the language to the written representation. I mean, that's what phonics is about in the final analysis, connecting sound of the language to its written representation.
Do you see my facial expression?
I do. Yeah, I
I'm
see you grimace.
not quite comfortable with that, but
I understand. That's what where we disagree. That's where we
that's right.
disagree. Yeah. No, I get it. I completely get it.
But this is good. All right. You're right. That's an area where we disagree. And on the efficacy of neurological research. All right. That's a good one as well. All right, I want to make sure we maintain our listeners, so I don't want to go too long. That's the only reason why I'm cutting this off. I could go
Agreed.
for another 2 hours with you, Claude. I really
Yeah.
could.
Likewise, Andy.
All right, so let me end the recording here.